Welcome to Tribal Histories, a Wisconsin Public Television original production, adapted for Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Comfort. These stories were recorded in the natural settings of the regions that Native people have called home for centuries. Tribal members share their challenges, triumphs, and time-honored traditions that have shaped their vibrant communities across generations. Today, we hear the histories of the Ho-Chunk Nation and the Bad River Ojibwe. By the banks of the Lemon Weir River, in what for ages had been Ho-Chunk territory, Andy Thundercloud shares the oral tradition of his people. Thundercloud tells of a migration across the land to become many different tribes. And then, by the Kakagan and Bad Rivers, three tribal elders share stories of the Bad River Ojibwe, from their early Lake Superior migration to a once-thriving lumbering community to the present-day honoring of traditions. Ho-Chunk history and Bad River Ojibwe history, coming up after the news. Welcome to Tribal Histories. First, the oral tradition of the Ho-Chunk Nation from Andy Thundercloud. We join him on the banks of the Lemon Weir River.
I was telling a friend of mine last night that I had a dream. And in this dream, there was a lot of old gentlemen. Old Ho-Chunks, and they were all speaking, and it became this one old gentleman's time to tell a story. You know, I learned this story from my grandfather, and the way that my grandfather tells the story is the way that I tell it. But this guy was older, much older. And he started us telling the story, and I could follow it. But he used words that I haven't heard. I've never heard. I inferred the meaning from the way he used it in the story, and I went and talked to my brother about it, my brothers, and we sat there and we talked about those words. It didn't ring a bell with any of us, you know, so I went back to the story and I told the story, and then I used that word. You know, and I go back and I'd say, okay, and this is where he used this word, and I'd use that word again, and he said that, now, your inference is probably correct, what you think that it means. I think that's what it means too, but I don't know what it means. I've never, you know. It's a good dream.
You are listening to Tribal Histories. We now rejoin Andy Thundercloud sharing the history of the Ho-Chunk Nation.
You know me well. My name is Andy Thundercloud. I'm a member of the Ho-Chunk tribe. My grandfather told me that we were always great people. He said that we were always respected by the tribes that surrounded us. And he said some of that respect even ran to fear, you know, because we were supposedly a very fierce, proud people, you know, that protected what we considered to be ours. The land that we considered to be home ran from, I guess, North Michigan, the Northern Peninsula, as far as Chicago, you know, because Chicago has a Ho-Chunk name, and then from there it ran to the west, the Mississippi, and then from there we back up north again. What we considered to be our land, you know, that we were given the responsibility of, what should I say, maintaining it, you know, as it should be, and that was, created for us, the creatures that we saw here, that we had here, were created for us, you know, as well as, you know, these trees, this grass, the water, everything was created for us, and they're all considered to be sacred by us. And we do our best to maintain that the relationship that we have with them. When we are going to use a tree for whatever purpose, we offer tobacco and a prayer, you know, that we're going to, you know, be taking this tree and we're going to be using it, you know, for a certain purpose. Same is true if we were going out to gather medicine. You know, I was sitting here looking around earlier and I was kind of going, you know, I wonder what kind of medicine is around here. You know, my grandfather used to take me out to gather medicines. And he would tell me, well, this medicine is used for this, and this medicine is used for that, and you can use it for this, and do it for that. And that he said that each time that we harvested some of that, you know, that we offered tobacco, that we were going to be using this for a purpose, you know, to make our people stronger and make our people well. But from what I gather from my history, grandfather said that we were traveling people. We've traveled throughout the continental United States. There have been stories of, I guess these are recent stories that, recent is, you know, if you take a look at it, consider colonial times, you know, back in the 1700s as being recent. There were stories of groups of our individuals that would travel east. It took them a long time to get to their destination. And the destination didn't have a Ho-Chunk name, so it was referred to as Boston. They went there to trade. You know, they took their objects that they were going to trade, and they traded for knives and, you know, metal objects. And once they traded, then they started their journey back. And from what I understand, that journey would often take 2 years, a year to get there and a year to get back. But I think the thing I distinctly remember my grandfather telling me is that, you know, to the west of us is the Great River, the Mississippi. And at one time there was a large number of us that went down the Mississippi and came to where the Missouri River and the Mississippi River come together. I guess that would be the area of St. Louis. And we settled there. For whatever reason, you know, there was some younger members of the tribe that became disgruntled. And they moved off to the west and a little bit south of there. There were others that became disgruntled and went up the Missouri River, settled in there, and some of them even went further up the Missouri River and settled up in the Dakota area. I've been told that many of the tribes that currently exist in Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, even Oklahoma, and are all originally Ho-Chunks. In fact, he told me a story. Sometimes during the 1800s, there was a large gathering of Indians in Omaha. I think there was the Poncas, the Otos, the Missouris, the Iowa, the Omahas, and some Sioux. There was a gentleman that came from the east. And this anthropologist asked these other tribes, where you reside now? Have you always resided there, or did you come from somewhere else? And each of them says, no, we came from Mokashuch. Mokashuch translates to Red Bank, the Green Bay area. I guess I could say our Garden of Eden, you know, because that's where we were created. So the Winnebago Ho-Chunk people, we were known as Winnebago at one time. I don't remember what tribe gave us that name, you know, but it was anglicized to Winnebago. To us, we've always been Ho-Chunk. Winnebago is a foreign name to me. I grew up with my grandfather. My grandfather raised me until I went to school. And during that time, I never spoke English. In fact, I distinctly remember the first time I saw a white person. I must have been 4 years old. And this white person came to the house asking for my grandfather. And I remember being a little bit astounded because he was a little white guy. He had just a little fringe of hair around here. But he spoke Ho-Chunk, you know, and that confused me. So after he left, I asked Grandpa, I said, Grandpa, who is that man? What family does he come from? What clan does he belong to? And Grandpa just laughed, you know, he just laughed and he thought it was funny. And he told me that they belong to a race that we call Mahekete, Big Knives. And that there were a lot of them in the world. And the world, as we knew it, was pretty much governed by what they did. And he said that I'd have to get used to it. He said, because you're going to run into them in your lifetime. A couple years later, when I started school, I found out what he was talking about. I started school, I wasn't able to speak any English at all. And I, you know, I think that I did well because I never was held up in any grades. Graduated eighth grade on time, graduated high school on time. I wish I could say the same thing about college, but I can't say that, but I did finally finish. And I'm a member of the Thunder Clan, and that's where our chiefs come from. And my grandfather always told me to conduct myself, you know, as such. He told me that we were the chiefs, he said, but never to say that. Never to come right out and use that as a way of being authoritative. He said that I don't do that because the way of the chief is hard. He said it's a very difficult life. And he said that I'm not capable of doing that. So therefore, you know, I don't call myself chief. We are divided into 12 clans. There are 8 clans that belong here on Earth, and there's 4 clans that belong up above. And in the past, each clan had a certain responsibility within the tribe to ensure that everything went well. They each had a certain area, you know, that they lived in. They took their responsibilities to heart and they did them well. You can take a look at it as each being different departments, maybe the Department of Transportation, Department of Commerce, Department of Agriculture, those kind of things. But that's the way the tribe was. Our modern government is more structured after, you know, what everyone does. We've got a president, we've got a legislature, so we've got the executive branch, we've got the judicial branch, we've got the legislative branch. You know, elections every 4 years and to elect our legislators and to elect our president. The president appoints heads of the various departments that we have within the tribe. Clans were created eons, thousands of years ago, through our origin stories. Those clans still exist today, but since we are not a central cohesive unit, until we come together for ceremonies, then those clan responsibilities kick in. You know, like I said, we of the Thunder Clan were the chiefs. It was our responsibility to see to the well-being of our people. If somebody came to us and said, I don't have a home, we'd immediately abandon what we were living in and said, here's your new home. Or if somebody come to us and said, we haven't been able to procure any food, and that's all we had to do is then we'd give them food and sustenance and whatever. And I think that's what Grandfather was talking about when he said it was difficult. You know, it's like in modern day times, if you were to come up to me and said, Andy, you know, I don't have a car. You know, and if I was a true chief, I'd reach in my pocket and say, here's your car. I'm a Thunder Clan because my father was a Thunder Clan. You know, we follow our father's lineage, although our mother's lineage plays a lot into it too. You know, I've tried to explain our relationships and I said, it's simple, you know, my father, all my father's brothers are my father's. Hence, all their children are my brothers and sisters. Okay, all my mother's sisters are my mother's. Hence, all their children are my brothers and sisters. Now, my mother's brothers are my uncles. And my father's sisters are my aunts. I have a nephew now that's, this is funny, okay. His father is my uncle, but his mother is my sister. Okay, so on his mother's side, I'm his uncle, you know, but on his father's side, he's my uncle, you know, so we're nephews to one another. And that's, you know, that's the way we address one another. It's a unique, you know, a unique relationship. My grandfather always said that, you know, I should be proud of who I am. and where I've come from. And he often told me stories about the Ho-Chunk people. He's told me stories about how large our tribe was at one time, you know, without even giving me any numbers, but I'm assuming that we ran into the tens of thousands, I don't know. He told me that we were created here. You know, I don't care, you know, what anthropologists have said. I firmly believe that, you know, this is where we were created and this is where we live. This is where we have lived. This is where we will continue to live as time goes on. Grandfather told me many stories. He said the coming of the white man changed a lot because he often told me that these white people think that they know something. He said, but they don't. But because of the, you know, the technology they had or the knowledge that that they had, we were forced to live in their style. Our relocation program that they had for us, we were moved to the West, forcibly removed to the West. And stories about when the troops, the federal troops, got back, the Ho-Chunks would be here waiting. There was a story about an old man who was well over 100 years old. His name was Yellow Thunder, and he was removed. And by the time the troops came back, he was sitting there waiting for them, you know, and whatever. And, that, and, the, and those stories go on. You know, I don't know how many times I think believe we were moved to Minnesota, northern Minnesota, then southern Minnesota. And then from there, we were moved to Crow Creek area in South Dakota. They didn't like it. It wasn't our home, and they grew very disgruntled, and some of them went down the Missouri River and settled among the Omahas, and sometimes in the past, we acquired half of their reservation. So therefore, we have a reservation in Nebraska. Here in the state of Wisconsin, we don't have a reservation. We do have land that belongs to the Ho-Chunk, and I don't know what that amount of land is. You know, there are certain members, you know, that are just bound and determined that, you know, that we need to get that land and whatever. And they've asked me what I thought. I'm a member of the Elder Council, you know, which is made up of elders from each of the clans, like we were set up at one time. And people come to us for advice. And I told them, all of this is sacred. That's what I've learned. I have no say-so about what happens here on the ground. That's Bear Clan responsibility. My responsibility is higher than that. You know, they always call me one of those uppity Thunder Clan people. You know, and it's jokingly referred to, but I'd like to think that we're apolitical, but we're not. Because we have a lot of authority, you know, just because of being an elder. I guess that's just kind of a brief history, you know, from what I've heard. You know, Grandpa could sit for hours and talk to me and tell me stories, and believe it or not, I was I could sit and listen to him, you know, because it was, you know, it always amazed me. You know, I guess we take a look at it and we think about it, and it was just like a book, you know, a book that you're. Your mother, father, or grandmother, or grandmother, grandfather would be reading to you because it was so interesting. You know, it just had my rapt, you know, as raptly intent on listening to what he said. Because I remember even going to bed at night and he'd be talking, you know, and I'd fall asleep and I'd wake up in the morning and he'd still, you know, he'd be talking again. You know, and I used to wonder, you know, think to myself, did he talk all night and I missed something? But I think the things that were of import, you know, he told me many times. Same with my father. My father would tell me things, and then in some place down the line again, he'd tell me again. And I never told him, you already told me that. You know, I would just sit and listen to them and nod, and they'd ask me if I understood. And even though I didn't understand, I'd say yes. I've told them to my children and my grandchildren exactly what my grandfather told me and exactly what my father told me. I blend history. I talk about our society. I talk about culture, just like I was sitting here talking about the trees and the grass and the earth itself, the water, and the relationship that we have with them. Each of what we see here has a story. You know, and that's part of our creation story. But it's many stories, you know, that follow the main line. There's the main stories, but there's many other little additions to it, you know, so that even after all these years, I don't think I know it all yet. But there's things that my grandfather has told me, you know, that I don't understand. Even to this day, I don't understand. But occasionally, I might see something, I might experience something, I might hear something. And then a little bell goes off in my head. Ding! That's what Grandpa was talking about. I said, no, and, you know, I have to think about it. You know, it might puzzle me. You know, that causes me some puzzlement. And doing things like that, or hearing things like that, and believing things like that, you know, it makes us who we are. You know, people often talk about culture, and I say culture is something very, very difficult to teach. I hope that's what I'm doing with my children, my grandchildren, and even the younger people that come to me seeking advice or seeking a story. I hope that I'm making them, you know, understand who we are. I want them to be proud, you know, who they are, who we are, because I'm very, very proud that we still exist, you know, that we still have our language, we still have our religions that we practice. You know, we just finished off a week-long ceremony here last week. We started Monday and we finished Sunday. And I think I'm recovered from that. Our ceremonies are, you know, they're religious. Just like any religion that we have is supposed to carry over into everyday things. And that's the way our ceremonies are. You know, the ceremony that we just finished is, we initiated a new member into our medicine lodge. And in doing so, we're praying, you know, for a long, fruitful, productive life for him in the path that he's taking, the path that he's going to be on. And I guess we spent the entire week telling him about the road that he's going to travel now. And, you know, the ways that he, to conduct himself, and, you know, those kind of things. And the understanding and the love that he should have for his fellow humans. We're going to always be here. Whether we're going to be here in Ho-Chunk name only, or whether we're going to be here as Ho-Chunks. Our language is what makes us who we are and what we are. Again, this relates back to a story. My grandfather said that we were given this language by Mauna, God, and as such that it's sacred. Our language to us is sacred, you know, that we should treat it that way, you know, and that we should use it that way. And then he said that one of these days, you know, this language is going to be gone. And when the language is gone, that's the end of the world. And I guess when I was younger, I used to think about, you know, the modern things, what they think about in Christianity, you know, the apocalypse, you know, great fire, you know, great storm, whatever else. And I thought it was completely the physical end of the world and whatever. But as time has gone along, is one of those occasions, like I said, oh, that's what Grandpa meant, you know. I see us becoming, for lack of a better word, I see us becoming more and more white as we lose our language, you know, and I see that among many of the tribes that I've gone to. You know, as they lose their language, they become more Europeanized, I guess would be, Anglicized or whatever. And I see that's what he meant. What we knew, what our grandparents knew, what our great-grandparents knew, what they followed, you know, it's going to be gone. That's why language is important to me, and it's very, very important to me, because I don't want to see us lose the beautiful life, you know, that we have, you know, that I've known. You know, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see my children lose that. I don't want to see my grandchildren lose that. My great-grandchildren lose that. I believe it's important, and I do my best to maintain our language. in July, I was given the responsibility of taking a new apprentice and teaching him our language. And I think he's doing very well. I think that in a matter of time, he's going to be an excellent speaker.
Ho-Chunk History was funded in part by Irene Danielle Kress, Francis A. and Georgia F. Ahrens Fund of the Community Foundation for the Fox Valley Region, EVU Foundation, Ron and Patty Anderson, Ira and Aneva Riley Baldwin, Wisconsin Idea Endowment, National Endowment for the Humanities, and Friends of Wisconsin Public Television.
You're listening to Tribal Histories. The storyteller you just heard was Andy Thundercloud from the Ho-Chunk Nation. Next, we hear from Mary Big Boy, Thomas O'Connor Sr., and Robert Paolo Sr., who share the stories of the Bad River Ojibwe. First, Thomas O'Connor Sr.
Dig it!
That's our quarters!
Katebi Marazi Wen Oma Nungum. I walked that old way here today yet. This is a very rich culture amongst our people. It was handed down by stories, by teachings only. Nothing was put down in a book and handed to us. This is a very simple way of life. This river right here is known as Muskiki Zeebing. And I still refer to that in my prayers and everything, Muskiki Zeebing. I do that because of the spirits yet to today. They only know that as Muskiki Zeebing, Medicine River. I don't like to use it as Bad River because our language, we have nothing bad to say about any of the Creator's creations. There's no such a word as bad, so this Bad River, I don't like the name of it, so I referred to what my prayer yet today is Muskiki Zeebing, Medicine River, and many dudes that Bimo say that walk on this water. They're right here with me today. And before I came here, I went in prayer and asked them that I say good things here today, you know, that I don't forget any of the really important things.
You're listening to Tribal Histories. Now, more of the history of the Bad River Ojibwe. Robert Paolo Sr., speaking Ojibwe.
Manuman, Missago, my capici gang, my mosha, no woman, and no washing, and give away, and give away, no more. Bungish, say, but I should negate the tone of my nibal, nibaka.
Mary Big Boy.
One of the things I think that I've seen over the years is that there has been a lot of change, and not only change in the environment, you know, things are a lot different now. When I take a ride out in the woods, I take a look and I see so much of the land has been clear cut. When I look out at the river, I don't see the rice like it used to be when I was younger. We lived down in Old Odena then, on Kakagan Street, and the nuns had their convent and also the school in the area where the church is now.
I grew up in this little community right down the road here. It's called Kakagan Street, in a great big house. It was called a mansion. It had 12 rooms upstairs and 7 downstairs. And we all had big homes around here years ago. That was during the lumber era, when everybody had money. There was all kinds of salesmen around here all the time selling rugs from Persia, and they had the big oak sliding doors in their homes, and I was fortunate enough to grow up in a house that had that.
1896, in the Chicago fire, they said they had enough lumber in there to rebuild Chicago. During the lumbering times, many of these people had lots of money, what they could get for their lumber, and they had to go through the Bureau to get it, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They had to write vouchers for whatever money they had needed, okay? Stearns, they ran the town. They had a store. You would work for them. They didn't give you money, they gave you credit. So you couldn't take your credit to a place in Ashland. You had to go to the store here, get a voucher, and do your shopping in that store. Prices marked up. Team of horses, $700. Maybe worth really about $350 if it was worth that. So it made its rounds like that, okay? All coming right back into Stearns's pocket. Huh?
And I can remember when I was a youngster, we used to have, still have that pole over there where it's at yesterday, but it was this time of the year. And they used to have old Model Ts, Model As in a circle, and they used to have like smudge pots all over also. Once in a while, they'd turn on their headlights of their cars and stuff, and everybody would be dancing out there and singing and smudge pots, and there'd be a bonfire there. They used to have a county fair there.
It used to be right in front of where my mom and dad had their house. I said, well, when you say fairgrounds, what do you mean? And she said, well, just like a county fair. She said they'd have vegetable displays, and they would have their bakery and their jams and their jellies, their canning. And she said that would be part of it, but a lot of it too had to do with more recreational type things. And it was a very important part of their entertainment at that time. My dad used to tell me, he said they would come from all over. I suppose if there was a ball game, you know, that was something very important to them. A lot of friendly competition between reservations when it comes to sports. Still is. Baseball games, that was the big thing here on the reservation for many years, right up until my sons were old enough to play.
We had some pretty good baseball teams here. A game every Sunday, grandstand popcorn and stuff. And a lot of these games that you see today, one game is lacrosse, you know, that we play today here. You know, I have a lot of lacrosse sticks and stuff given to me by the elders. I still have them at the house. Lacrosse was given to our people there. There was an elderly woman, she was real sick. In this guy's dream, he had a dream about this game. In that dream, it said to make these sticks, to make a ball out of a knot and how to play it. And so all the energy they spent on that field that day, them young Braves and stuff, went into that woman. And that woman slowly got better and better, and that's how they healed. And most of all these games you see today that we play has got to do with that healing part, like in a healing ceremony.
They had fairs here. You'll see pictures, but that's all you see, all right? See all those houses around, where are they? They're gone.
That highway was built there in 1936 or something, 37. And it kind of closed off this community here. It's like a dike. So this water had no place to run anymore, this Bad River. So it plugged it up, and then there's all them houses here. It had 100 houses right over there, starting on the corner over there. And it just flooded everything, and it waterlogged them. They never had the money to fix the houses, and so that's why this community fell apart.
I lived through those floods. And the biggest one I can remember happened in 1946. It was huge. My parents went into Ashland to grocery shop, and on our way back, we couldn't make it back to our house because that's how fast the water came up. And it was a large area that it covered. It was during that flood where the St. Mary's School, a section of it collapsed. A lot of us went to school there, and I graduated from there in eighth grade. Sometimes you didn't want to go there either, you know, because there was a lot of things that we were expected to do by the teachers and by the nuns. There's some good memories, and then there's some not so good memories. And I can remember this one time I went to a ceremony. I must have been probably fifth grade, sixth grade. And I went with my grandmother to the ceremony. And I don't know how the nuns found out about it. But when I got to school at Monday morning, they sent me to the principal's office. And I had to sit on the floor in the principal's office all day because I went to the ceremony. And I think it was a lot of misunderstanding on their part because we all worship the same thing, the same being, whether you call them the Great Spirit or whatever. You know, and I don't think they realize that. That's why in my generation, nobody can fully understand their language because we weren't allowed to speak it when we went to school.
We went down to see a ceremony. And while we were watching that ceremony, this girl was starting to cry. She was remembering then about her grandma. They were laying in bed when she was about 8 or 9 years old, and that's when she started school. And she didn't know no English until that. Okay? She started school. And then she was crying because her hands were all cut up. That's from taking that ruler with that little iron thing, that metal strip on the bottom, right, and hitting you on the back of your hands like that for speaking the language. I told her grandma, well, the grandma says, well, you'll have to forget your language then. Now, that's only one story, but there was lots of them like that.
My father picked a day he'd go down and check Kakagan over there. Right now it's wild rice time, we'd be ricing, me and him together. I started out when I was ricing when I was 9 years old with him. Very young age, and I raced to him till about 30, when I was 30 years old after I come back from the service. And he taught me a lot, and he didn't teach me a lot. He just said things that if I was supposed to pick them up and carry them on with me, that's the way it was supposed to be today.
It's very important to us, you know, as a people. Because first of all, it's a staple, something that we all enjoy using. And another thing is it gives us that time of the year and in the fall when we go out and actually participate in a cultural event that our ancestors did. You know, and that's important. And it was a good time because you had a chance to socialize, you had a chance to rest, of course, because ricing is hard work. But when you're out there, you enjoy it. It's not work because it's a way of life, you know. We would go down and knock the rice, what they call knock it, and it's just taking the stalks and pulling them into the canoe or your boat and hitting them so that the kernels fall off. And once you get to as much as you think you needed, then you would come in.
This time of the year, standing up on the bank there, my grandma came up from ricing and they had a little, what we call a rice boat, a homemade boat out of lumber. Grandma was sitting in there. There was so much rice like this from one end there. There was only about that much freeboard. That's how much rice they made that day. And then they laid their rice out the next day and dried it in the sun.
Once it got to a certain point, then my mom and dad would take it and they would what they call scorch it. And she had this big black kettle in. After supper, the job then would be go out and help my mom build the fire first so that she could scorch the rice. And then they would store it in either bags or paper boxes. And it was my job to go out there and dance the rice. And when you say dance, you put two poles up, and my dad used to have a little pit and he would line it, put the rice in there, and then I would put on a pair of moccasins and I would get in there and you move your feet back and forth to get the husk, loosen the husks. And then once that's done, then you put it in these birch bark baskets my grandma used and my dad did too, in what you call winnow it. It means you toss the rice up so that the chaff, they called it mazon, would separate from the kernels.
They had 9 of them big great sacks like that, cleaned rice, that was going to last them all winter. But they were down there, that whole family was down there and had to work. Surviving.
As I got older, the whole concept changed a little bit. We still went out and got our rice that we needed to get us through the winter. But then there were rice buyers here, and they would come down and buy the green rice from you. And back in those days, that was probably in the 50s, early 60s. It was a means of earning extra money, you know, to go out and buy school clothes for your kids. It was important for people at that time. From what I hear and from what my sons tell me, because they learned how to rice when they were probably 12 and 13 years old, if not younger. Now they go down to the rice fields and they said it's nothing like it used to be. They said, Mom, if we took you down there, you'd cry.
The old way people that were following that way of life stayed here because they could live off the land. It's a very simple life. You know, it's not that hard to follow. They'll teach you it. They'll send you for tobacco. Come on to the camp tonight and sit around the fire and stuff, and they'll tell stories about the old way of life and stuff like that. That's the way I learned.
I remember so many stories that my grandma would tell me. She loved to tell stories about what I imagined life was back when my ancestors came here. And when she would come to our house, I would sit on her lap, and what I've learned is that the Ojibwe people once lived on the East Coast, and because of conflicts with the Onondagas, Tuscaroras, and those tribes, they began to migrate inland. And according to legend, that they followed this, they call it the Magis, which is supposed to be shell. But to me, it was almost like a star. You know, as I got further and further into reading about it, and this light or this object brought them to this area. From there, they branched out. Some of them went to the north shore of Lake Superior, and our tribes were then located at La Pointe, island of La Pointe. That's kind of like the motherland of the Ojibwe people. From there, they dispersed to other areas. As far as Bad River is concerned, I've heard so many different versions. One of them is, we came here because of the rice.
I used to talk to the elders over there. They were telling me that they lived around that time when they were sending people to different reservations, like LCO and Lac des Flambeaux, Bad River and Red Cliff, and La Butte is there. And when they were selecting people to go, they were taking families. Oh, you go here, you go there, you go here, you go there. And then when they never mentioned this place over here, Muskeke Zeebe and Medicine River over here. So these people were being the last ones there. They were asking the Indian agent, well, what about us? He said, oh, go on to the side, he said. I want to send all you pagans over to Muskeke Zeebe. So this is why, this is kind of a place where there was the last stand right here of the drums and stuff like this. It all came back out of here and went to all these reserves. The guy said that when they travel here from different reservations and they're following their way of life some other place, and he said they don't understand why they feel so good when they come here, because this is where the spirits made their last stand here. We went with the people who followed that way of life.
2 years in graduate school. Anthropology. And there was a saying, with if Indians get into anthropology, they have a hard time in there, but I live on that stuff. And I had an argument for all that good stuff that they had. We got some ceremonies that we do, okay? And one of them ceremonies is what we call Jisakon, shaking tent. The anthropologist, if he sees that, he said, if you can do it, I can do it, but he never could. Now, why is that? Why, what happens, okay, with something like that? Why can't they do that? There's something about us that allows us to do something like that, and I don't know what it is. And then that lodge, there is also part of that culture in there that we followed at that time.
And the Madewin, the lodge, from the beginning of our people, it's been there. The way my grandma explained it to me, it's like a learning. There's different degrees that you need to advance through, and it's mostly like healing. You learn about different medicines. She said it's something that's very sacred to our culture, and that in order to be able to understand it, you need to live it. She said it's not something like at that time I was just a kid, and she said, like, you go to school, and she said, and you're in school for how many hours a day? And I told her, 8 hours, Graham. And she said, well, with the Madewin, it's every day, every night. You have to live it. She said, and a lot has to do with respecting Mother Earth, respecting each other. She said, and living that. She said, it's not something to be taken lightly, and not something that you need to fear, she said, because you learn about life and how the Creator wants you to live it.
There's many secret societies out there that I still go to yet. We have never took pictures of them or taped them or nothing like that. They're special songs that were handed down. They used to have Indian police here years ago because they were scared of that big drum ceremony. So what the elders did at that time, the big drum people, is they told the BIA that if they could have these powwows we see today, if we could have these powwows openly, then they wouldn't have the big drum anymore. So the BIA thought that was a pretty good thing. They didn't know at the time that there were special people around that dance circle. What they were doing is they were handing them songs to the powwows like we're having today here. They did it openly then with the big drum. So that way they never had to hide it anymore. So that's why the big drum survived today, and it's very strong. But now they went back to what they did years ago. It's a secret ceremony right now, you know, like 3-4 day ceremony. That drum can still speak to all the spirits that the Creator put you. You know, it still is.
You know. You grow up in that. See, that's it. Wherever you came from, you had a culture in right in your house. You grew up, you did things different in your house than your neighbors did. Sometimes they wonder what you're doing over there. Well, then they see you do something, they say, what are them people doing? They're crazy. You say the same thing about them, okay?
What I see as being really a positive thing is a lot of our young people going back to their culture. You know, they're going to ceremonies. They're participating in powwows, not only here, but all over. And I think that we need to keep that so our youth learn what it's like to really be Indian, you know, learn the values. Some of us along the way didn't take the time to learn about some of those things and don't realize that, you know, that's the important thing of our culture. Not whether you wear your hair in braids or you wear your beads, it's what's inside of you. That's what's important.
We never dance for ourselves out there. We always dance for something. Like me now, when I go dance out there, I'll try to imitate the eagle. The eagle, they tell us the story of when the Creator was going to destroy our people. Because we were bad at one time, you know what I mean? We drifted from that good life to that bad side, not respecting anybody or loving anybody. That eagle we see all the time whenever we're having the ceremonies, he's seen that there were still good people amongst our people. So when he heard about what the Creator was going to do, he went and talked to the Creator for our people, that they were still praying and they were still sharing and they were still loving, and to let us follow that way of life with the spirits. So the Great Spirit, he thought about it. To the eagle, he said, from now on, it's going to be your duty to fly over these people, he says. And if there's ever a day where you don't see them prayers or sharing or loving each other, it's your duty to tell me. At the pole, you're going to see these eagles come here, sometimes three or four in the sky flying over this pole grounds here. So he feels good when he's circling up there that he can still report back to the Creator that we're still praying and having that good way of life yet with the drums.
Bad River Ojibwe history was funded in part by Irene Danielle Kress, Francis A. and Georgia F. Ahrens Fund of the Community Foundation for the Fox Valley Region, EVU Foundation, Ron and Patty Anderson, Ira and Aneva Riley Baldwin, Wisconsin Idea Endowment, National Endowment for the Humanities, and Friends of Wisconsin Public Television.
This has been part two of Tribal Histories, a Wisconsin history project by Wisconsin Public Television and Wisconsin Historical Society. It was produced and edited by Mick Dirks. The storytellers this hour were Andy Thundercloud, Mary Big Boy, Thomas O'Connor Sr., and Robert Paolo Sr. Sound design by Tom Nounis. Original music by Wade Fernandez. Production assistance by Donna Crane. Our director of production is Kathy Beeson. This program was adapted for radio by Jennifer Dargan, Tom Blaine, and Joe Hartke. You can find the video for this program at wpt.org/tribalhistories.